Sometimes I think when I get up in the morning and I go to the bathroom and I look in the mirror, you know, one of my eyeballs is going to fall. You have no idea what's going to happen every day when you wake up after a certain age. But again, you know, if you feel self-compassion, it's going to be a lot easier.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. This is U-Turns, the podcast about change, all kinds of change, external and internal change, because shift happens. I am Lisa Oz.
And I'm Jill Herzig.
And today we are actually going to talk about aging.
Self-image. Let's put a nicer term on it.
How do you make it nice? I mean, is there like a...
All right, screw it. Let's just talk about aging. Let's do it. We're here with Val Monroe.
Hi, guys.
A longtime friend. So excited. Val is an expert in beauty culture. For years and years, she was the editor, the beauty director at O, the Oprah magazine, and a very different kind of beauty director, I have to say. I come from magazines, so I know all kinds of beauty directors. And she was the fabulous exception to the general rule. Millions of people read her, followed her Ask Val column. I was one of them. And just so thrilled to have
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and congratulations, guys.
Thank you. We're excited.
Yes, we're just kind of plunked in the middle of our U-turn and talking about it.
We were intimidated by you coming, that we put makeup on today.
Oh, no. I hope not. You're both so beautiful. I keep saying that to all these women, you know, who always say, I was afraid, you know, to meet you or afraid to see you because I thought you'd be critical of the way I look. And I got that a lot when I was an active beauty director, and I was always saying, you know, just like be yourself with me, please, you know.
But that's not when they came to the Hearst building, because I was just going to, Jill and I were talking about this, when you work in publishing, you can't even go through the door. They will turn you away at the door if you don't come with your perfect hair and your perfect nails and your high heels. And
it was something about working in publishing that actually made me a little crazy. I mean, I used to say to people when they ran into me on the street, and I could instantly see that adjustment in their face when I was in my work mode, you know, is kind of like what you're talking about. I just wanted to say, this is just a costume. Conversely, like I would walk by people on the weekends who I worked with and saw regularly, and they would not recognize me at all. I could virtually wave at them and they'd just be like, who's that crazy lady with the bags under her eyes? I don't know that one.
Really?
I mean, it just, it really was this costume. And I can't say that was, you know, I didn't enjoy the dress up part of it the way I think some people do. And I especially didn't enjoy the fact that it put some people on edge and made them assume that I was holding them to some kind of standard, which I was not.
So that's very hard to get around, I think, because it's not you holding them to that standard, but it's themselves. So, and to the point of, you know, what you feel like when you walk into, for example, the Hearst building, or I actually have worked at Condé Nast too, and I think it was worse at Condé Nast.
Yeah. The elevator at Condé Nast
was really
a
difficult.
Brutal, brutal place. You had to survive that every morning before you even started.
But it's all carnivorous beasts. Oh,
my God, just the, you know, we used to call it elevator eyes, which is just the up and down.
Right.
Both because the eyes go up and down, and because it happened so often in the elevator and just made you feel, you know, I don't know, 3 inches tall and 3 feet wide and, you know, just not good.
That's such a shame, because I think when that happens, it's likely unconscious on the up and down person's part. A friend of mine a colleague of mine at the magazine once pointed out to me that I did that. I was completely unaware of it. And I'm sure I was making some kind of judgment, but I wasn't conscious of it.
Right.
So,
do you think you were just trying to take somebody in?
In some way, but I don't think that's really an excuse in a way. I was taking, when I was doing it with a woman, I was taking her in many ways, you know, as a competitor, probably, as judging her on her, even her class, you know, those kinds of distinctions that I think we make unconsciously.
It's hard to turn that off.
It's very hard to turn that off, especially when you're in a community or a context where it's almost expected of you. And, you know, as I said earlier, you know, when you walk into, say, the Hearst building or Condé Nast building, that judgment is largely self-imposed, because you honestly don't know what other people are thinking of you, even when they're looking you up and down the elevator. I think the key to getting past that is to encourage compassion for yourself up to a point where it won't matter anymore. And, I say that kind of blithely, but it's hard to do, but it's possible to do.
Yeah. So it's self-compassion you're talking about, which
is yeah.
something that's coming up for us in conversations around change.
I think part of it is, too, I notice just a trick I do when I'm feeling incredibly judged, like in an elevator where it's the up and down. If you just smile at that person, it breaks the tension and then it gets them out of their head of whatever they're thinking about you. And they don't want to think those things about you. And they suddenly like have a connection with you.
Yeah.
And you're both getting out of your own heads and into a relationship. That just helps me a lot.
Yeah. So that actually, I think, is one of the main key components of self-compassion. But what I suggest is that you not only do it with other people, but that you do it with yourself. Because one of the things that I feel so passionate about is the way we look at ourselves when we look in the mirror. Because we're taught from the time we're basically infants that when we look at our reflection, we objectify ourselves. And if you think about self-objectification, what that is you're looking at your image through the eyes of someone else you believe is judging you. It's a third person, basically, or a second person, right?
Lots of people in the room when you're standing there in the bathroom.
There are.
In front of a mirror.
There are. And that's often why women feel that a mirror is not their friend. And if you can learn to look at yourself in a way that decreases the self-objectification, you'll see that your feelings about yourself are really, really different. So I wrote a little piece about this when I was at the magazine because somebody had sent me a photo of me I was at a party and I was face to face in conversation with that gorgeous creature, Mrs. David Bowie.
Iman,
right? And as I looked at the picture, as I described it, I felt as if I had just opened a bouquet to discover that the flowers were like a day old. Mm. And she looked to me like an outrageously beautiful orchid, hothouse orchid, in full bloom. And I looked like a parking lot daisy, at the end of the day. So I went over to the mirror in my office and I looked into my own eyes for a little bit. And I kept looking until I actually saw myself. And then I said, hi, sweetie. And all of that judgment and objectification went away. So when I would talk to groups of people about this experience, it wasn't very helpful, I don't think, in a way, because it was all about my own experience. I had no way of helping them do it for themselves. It's a very hard thing to do if you've ever tried looking into a mirror, into your own eyes for any length of time.
Yeah.
It's difficult. And then I discovered this teacher at Barnard, her name is Tara Well, who has done studies on what she calls mirror meditation. Huh. And she encourages her subjects to look at themselves in the way that I did, and then has tracked how they feel about themselves. She tracks their self-esteem. She tracks their objectification.
Does she have them speak to themselves the way
you don't have to say anything. Yeah. No, you just have to, you have to be able to confront the feelings, whatever feelings come up when you look at yourself. That's something that I wrote about when I wrote this piece. And I was almost embarrassed to write about what I felt because it's so intimate.
Yeah.
But if you can actually sit there and do that, and in a way, you're befriending yourself in the way, Lisa, you just spoke about trying to befriend someone in an elevator.
Right.
You know, your whole experience about who you are as you present yourself to the world shifts in a way that's very, I don't like to use this word, but it's very empowering.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, we used to go in a closet with a mirror and the lights turned off and I have to stare in it. So I'm still a little nervous about doing that. Remember that game? It was Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary. You never played this game?
No.
Oh my gosh. So too much staring into the mirror.
Is it possible your family made it up?
No, it was our whole town. It was a scary game.
And only Lisa played.
No. I didn't. I wouldn't play.
I don't know.
It was
we just did garden variety Ouija board.
You guys were creative. But the mirror isn't the place that bothers me so much. I'm okay with it because you can always adjust, whatever. And I recognize myself in the mirror less and less as I get older. But it's still me. Where I don't recognize myself is in my cell phone. That is so much harder to look at. Like when I'm on Skype with, if you talk to someone on. I don't even know who that person is. I don't want to talk to them because then I have to have a little image of me coming up when I'm Skyping them. That I hate. Mm-hmm. And I can't, staring into those eyes isn't going to help me at all. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why anyone would want to look at like a terrible photo of themselves, because that's what that is. I mean, it's just like, you know, so don't look. I mean, you know, that reminds me of what I said to some of my friends when they would say, you know, like, oh, I hate my neck, or I hate my chin, or I hate my eyes. I would just say, well, look at something else, you know, go to the museum and look at a Van Gogh, you know. Right. I mean, that works up to a point, because if a body part is making you feel really uncomfortable, and I say, you know, like, just do whatever you want, right. Do whatever you can to make yourself feel better about it. But I always encourage one to do the self, you know, the de-objectification first, because whatever you do after that is going to feel a lot better, no matter what you choose.
I once wrote a line. We had something when I was an editor at Glamour magazine, which was called the It's Okay list, which is exactly what it sounds like, a whole list of things that really are just freaking okay. Don't worry about it. And I remember, I think maybe the best contribution I ever made was only believe the skinny mirrors. So that's my word of wisdom to you, Lisa. Mm-hmm. Don't believe your phone. It's like the equivalent of a fat mirror. Mm-hmm.
You know, it is. I mean, the selfie obsession is, I just don't get it.
Never trust.
I think if
the
I were
selfie.
20, maybe I could get this.
It's terrible.
Selfie.
It's terrible for everyone. It's terrible for 20-year-olds, because what you see is not real, and it's presented as what is real. And so we look at these images and we think, oh my God, she looks so much better than I do, when we don't know what she actually looks like. I mean, I keep thinking of that, of Jane Fonda at the Oscars this year when she looked like a Barbie doll?
Yeah.
Right? So, I say more power to her. She was having fun. You know, she looked, I mean, at the choice of that particular image I found somewhat jarring, because I do think she's a feminist, but the problem with it is that I think so many women look at that and think, God, she's 80. How does she look like that? Well, I've seen her in person. She doesn't look like that. That's a costume, as you were saying, Jill, earlier, you know.
Yeah.
It's a costume, and it's a very sophisticated one, because it's not, you know, she doesn't put that together. She's got experts putting that together for her. And so what we're presented with on television, you know, with selfies, we're presented with all these images that don't really reflect what people look like. So there's this other reality that we're now comparing ourselves to, even younger women who are asking more and more for procedures because they think that's what they should look like, and it's not. It's not possible.
Yeah. We will come back to this after the break.
Okay. Yeah.
Before the break, we were talking about, well, Jane Fonda, for one, and her beautiful but produced appearance. I want to shift gears a tiny bit and talk about identity, right? And how, when we feel like our appearance is a big part of who we are, and then that changes, how do we grow into that evolving sense of self?
With great difficulty, I have to say. So I'm going to go back to, you know, at the risk of sounding like a one-note song, I'm going to go back to self-compassion, because, you know, as we get older, things start to get loose and fall off, and, you know, we have to deal with
them. Take them back on.
We can do that if we have the means to do that.
Yeah.
I actually, you know, sometimes I think when I get up in the morning and I go to the bathroom, I look in the mirror, you know, one of my eyeballs is going to fall. You have no idea what's going to happen every day when you wake up after a certain age. But again, you know, if you feel self-compassion, it's going to be a lot easier. So I was thinking about my 93-year-old mother, who lives on her own. You know, she's very independent. But I'm watching her as she's dealing with all these, you know, kind of one loss after another with her friends, you know, or with her physical attributes. And what is supporting her through this is her ability, her resilience comes from self-compassion, basically. It's about, you know, feeling good about herself in spite of all of the things that are happening to her. And I think the older you get, the more loss there is, you know, there's a feeling, at least I've experienced this, of the potentially feeling betrayed by my body, you know, that I've relied on for my identity because fortunately, you know, I have gotten good feedback about it. And suddenly either there's no feedback or there's feedback I don't like, or I'm searching for feedback that, you know, isn't forthcoming. And if I can, instead of feeling betrayed or feel, you know, this profound sense of loss alone, only if instead I can feel towards myself the way I would feel towards my maybe 6-year-old self if I felt this disappointment and sadness, which is to say, you know, you put your hand over your heart as you would for a child, or you hold your face the way you would hold a child's face, and you just say, you know, I'm sorry, it's okay, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
I, you know, as I say it, it sounds so woo-woo and so cliched, but it actually
Jen's
works.
Jill's favorite word.
I know. I am the least woo-woo person. There are many mm-hmm. moments when I think, huh, this U-turn would be easier if I was more invested mm-hmm. in the woo-woo. Mm-hmm. But I am not. I am deeply mm-hmm. a practical shoes person. Mm-hmm. So everybody mm-hmm. knows.
Well, you know, self-compassion is very practical.
Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds like something I should kind of take out and dust off every day.
Is the opposite of that, though? I mean, taking that to an extreme, just throwing in the towel, like wearing sweatpants, which I literally have done many times in my life, where it's like ponytail, sweatpants, no makeup, I don't care, eat the gallon of ice cream and just say, screw it, and, you know, judge me as you will.
So I love that idea, as long as you don't hate yourself for it. Because that's the opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can do that, as some women can, and just say the hell with it. I mean, there's a certain that some women age, you know, into a muumuu and rubber sole shoes and their, you know, WNET tote bags, and they're perfectly happy with that. And, you know, whatever, that's great. In fact, I love to see, there's a certain kind of woman in her maybe 70s, mid-70s, who you often see on the streets in New York, and she's often, you know, kind of short, and she's kind of heavy, and she's usually big-bosomed, and she's wearing, you know, very comfortable shoes. She's got her backpack or whatever, short hair, no makeup, and she looks very comfortable with herself.
Hustling along, doing that New Yorker lady walk.
Yeah. And I kind of admire that. I'm not there, personally.
Yeah.
But that's her choice, you know. If you can make that choice and not feel like you're, for some reason, Lisa, giving up.
But the thing with you, Lisa, is that you hit every mark on the continuum. So I love that, you know, I remember once we had a shoot at your house for the Dr. Oz magazine, and you had a terrible cold, and you came downstairs, and there were, oh my God, we had totally taken over your house. It was horrible what we did to you. Mm-hmm. And you came downstairs, and you were in exactly the mode you're talking about. You'd barely slept. You were in sweats. Your hair was in a ponytail. You're like, oh, hi, everybody. You couldn't have been nicer.
No.
But you were clearly suffering. And what I loved was that you were not going to, like, I don't know, do a little something-something.
it would have been futile.
But it also just, you just didn't care in that moment. And yet, I have also seen you as you are... possibly the best non-professional makeup artist that I know. I have seen you head to toe glam, and I've seen you every place in between, which I think is kind of amazing. Whereas what I was saying before is, like, I kind of only have a couple modes. My gear shift either sticks here or it sticks all the way down here. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. Like, as I've gone through this shift and this identity change, one of the things I have not been able to do is figure out whether all those editor-in-chief clothes should just be taken to the consignment store.
No, mm-hmm. They look so good on you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thank you so much. Haven't worn them. Mm-hmm. Don't.
You can wear them here to the podcast.
I am wearing strange polka dot pants today, which come from the editor-in-chief wardrobe. But basically, you know, one thing I wonder about is, you know, if I want to accelerate change, do I need to shift all of that stuff out of my out of my, at least out of my sight lines.
So it completely depends on what kind of change you want to shift to.
Yeah.
Because it's all about what you feel comfortable, I think. Yeah. You know, if you feel comfortable with those clothes, fantastic. Wear them. I mean,
if I felt super comfortable in them, I would wear them to the grocery store. And I'm not doing that.
Uh-huh.
Well, literally, some of them I have to dust. Uh-huh. The shoes need dusting.
Well, and heels are a whole other.
Oh my God. I mean, I feel like I should take out a hot glue gun and just make some kind of a sculpture for my backyard out of these shoes.
Well, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Or you might sell them on eBay because they're probably very expensive.
Yeah, they're nice shoes.
Or find someone who's a size 7. Are you a size 7, Val?
Well, I was just going to say, do we only look nice for other people? Do we never?
Well, that's where objectification comes down. I mean, if you look in the mirror and you love the way your face looks without any makeup, I mean, if you can look at yourself in the morning when you first get up and say, hi, sweetie, to your face and not feel like, Jesus Christ, you know, like what happened overnight, I think, you know, you're going to be a much happier person. I don't think it's easy to do, but I actually had an experience recently with a friend who's a psychiatrist who was complaining about her own feelings about the way she looks as she's getting older, you know. And I said, geez, you know, I don't have that right now. I mean, I have great lighting in my bathroom. I spent a lot of time.
Treat
yourself
to good lighting.
A lot of time.
Yes.
Figuring out, I did a lot of research about what bulbs to get.
Yeah, and, that's self-compassion right there.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Anyway, so I said, I actually don't feel that right now. And I think I look my age and I look in the mirror and I'm fine with it. And she looked at me and she said, well, of course, you're in denial. And I was like, but she's right. She's right. I don't see myself the way other people see me. I see myself the way I see me. And I like the way I see me. Now, if you guys said to me,
a little bit, how dare she for messing with that?
Oh, no.
It's not messing.
Oh,
you can't mess
with
it.
Not at all. Okay. Not at all. No, I mean, I trust her.
Yeah.
But my point is that, you know, there's kind of nothing that people could say to me that would shift my self-compassion, I think, in a way that you know, was real for me.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you guys said to me now, Jesus, Val, how old are you? Like 95?
No. You look incredible. And actually, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the fact that, you know, particularly through all those years where you were the O-Beauty director.
And the oldest.
Really?
The oldest, yeah, until one retired, and then I became, then I was older, like by 15 or 20 years than everyone else.
And maybe that's what made you the best.
I think it made me the
what
most
made you the best. What made you maybe the best is that you had never been a beauty director before you got to O.
Mm-hmm. So I was discovering, along with our readers, I was discovering, you know, everything that I needed to learn as a beauty editor.
Yeah. And you kind of never lost your feminist take as well on beauty. I felt like
that's
that was there.
Irony right there, isn't it? The feminist beauty editor?
No. I didn't think so because I was. I actually was in a very particularly protected position working for the Oprah magazine because when I was there for the large part of the time I was there from, say, 2001 to 2010, 2008, 2010, when Oprah's show was still on the air and she, basically, she was the goose that laid the golden egg, I could do anything I wanted, basically, as the beauty. I really wasn't tied to pleasing the advertisers in a way that all other beauty editors were.
So you could say, don't use an eye cream.
Well, I did.
I know.
Actually, I did.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, when some advertisers would talk to me, when I knew that it was just BS, I actually, at one point in front of my publisher, one day, put my hands over my ears and went, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I was a scamp.
Yeah.
Because I could be, because I was protected.
Yeah.
That all changed.
And you were actually under marching orders to rebel against anything that didn't
feel right to you.
That's
right. And the authenticity of the beauty pages in the magazine were a reflection of Oprah's authenticity.
Yeah.
And the authenticity of the magazine in general.
Yeah.
And we were very proud of that.
There were these beautiful makeovers. I remember them through that stage where, you know, the woman's story and what she'd been going through was a big part of it. It seemed like you almost never did a straight up makeover. Here she doesn't look good, but here she does. Totally different before after approach.
So, and those were so much fun to do. And behind the scenes, what you didn't know was that I always took the woman by the hand and said, we're going to do something for you that you will be able to continue to do after you leave the studio. And then I always spoke to the hairstylist or the makeup artist to say, you know, do whatever you need to do for the photograph. But please make sure that she leaves with an idea of what she can do on her own and a couple of products so that she can that she can continue to do.
And did you ask them to keep it simple enough that it was something you could actually do every day without making yourself nuts?
That was part of the that was part of the point.
Yeah.
Because what you do for a photograph is just like ridiculously complicated.
Yes.
And, you know, we considered doing a couple of recidivism stories, you know, to see like what happened to the women like 10 years later. But it didn't really work because it's not practical, you know, to go back to somebody 10 years later and say.
Well, it could be all kinds of things that
exactly right.
That are causing recidivism.
This is true. There's something just about it being Oprah's magazine also and her being on the cover every month because she's not a model. She's not Tyra, but she looks amazing. And so the message that you're telling people is you may not be a model, but you can feel great about the way you look and you can put your best self forward, which is Oprah's thing, right? Was always being your best self.
Live your best life, yeah.
Yeah.
I was on a panel not too long ago with a young woman who was bragging about how her magazine, what was that word that everybody used, was a great disruptor, right? And I said, really? Because in 2001, the Oprah magazine started putting a slightly overweight black woman on its cover every month.
Yeah.
What do you think about that being
disruptive? Yeah. How's that?
So I think, you know, for many years, that magazine, her magazine, like her show and like her, had a tremendous effect on raising people's consciousness about the way they feel about themselves, about what their choices are, about who their role models might be. Because just by the virtue of being who she is, she introduces a whole new role model for people who might not have thought that that was available to them.
Yeah. A friend of mine actually worked as one of the casting people. Oh, had a very different structure.
And the magazine?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was a freelancer, and she basically just walked the streets of New York looking for unusual, fascinating-looking women.
So one of the women we used to—
Not models, decidedly not models.
Right. That's what we used to do. One of the women who we used to—one of my favorite makeover stories, I found when I was biking, as I am wont to do, up and down the bike path along the Hudson, and I stopped at one of the piers, and I saw this woman climbing out of the water pier. And I was looking at her, I was like, oh my God, she is so gorgeous. What? And the way I described her was, you know,
So she had actually been swimming.
She had been swimming in the water.
No, she was a mermaid. She was emerging like Venus de Milo.
I'm just trying, you know, I am a New York City person, child of the
70s. She was swimming in the Hudson.
Okay.
With a group,
the Hudson was a very scary place when I was growing up. And it still is.
Yeah. So she pulled herself out of the water and I got off my bike and I went over to her and the way I wrote about it was, you know, I noticed she had, her hair was like wet, slicked back. She had what I thought was maybe eyeliner or it could have been sludge. I wasn't sure.
Raccoon eyes.
That's a smoky
and
eye,
I said, what the heck? You know, and it turned out she's like an EMT. She was training for something. We used her. And so I said, well, what's your beauty routine? And, you know, she spent like $35 a year. But she was stunning.
Yeah, how old was she?
In her 30s.
Yeah.
Mid-30s.
Everybody's still pretty in their 30s.
Well, she was beautiful. Yes, I agree. I also think everybody's still pretty in their 40s.
In a different way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So we made her over in a way that was very simple, and I cataloged her beauty routine. And then we compared her to another woman who spent, I think it was like $55,000 a year on products and procedures. And so it was really fun.
Yeah.
That was one of our most fun makeover stories.
High maintenance versus super low maintenance.
But to your point, I found her climbing out of the river.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to get back to that question of self-care and how much is enough and how much is too much. We're going to break for 1 second.
Okay.
Before the break, we were talking about self-care and how much is too much. And I personally think part of the problem is societal, in that when I was growing up, there was an entirely different expectation for what I would buy and do, whether it was my beauty routine or my fashion, from what my mother would buy or wear. And now it seems like it's just, so there was no competition between a 50-year-old woman or a 40-year-old woman and a 20-year-old. It was, you were like
different
species,
yeah.
Right? And now it's like everybody's in the same pool. You date people who are 20 years younger than you are. Everybody wears Dolce & Gabbana, and we all use the same beauty stuff, even if my daughters, literally Daphne and I exchange moisturizers and toners and whatever.
How old is she?
31.
And Valis, you were saying it kind of cuts both ways. So women in their 20s who have zero to worry about in the looks department are asking for procedures and paying top dollar for products because somehow they've gotten infected with worry about their looks. Mm-hmm. How did we do that to them? Mm-hmm. What did we do?
So I think you know, the selfie generation, you know, has a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think, I mean, framing aging in terms of worry and you know, despair is just so, sad, you know, and I know we do it because
we do it because we feel there's a perception that you're not valued.
That's right.
As an older woman.
Exactly right. And somebody said to me recently, you know, when I was at an event and it happened to be on my birthday, and I told her that I'm 67, and she's like, oh my God, you know, 67. I'm like, all I want is to remain relevant. I just want to feel relevant. And relevance is such an important word. And I think one of the ways we try to do that is through our appearance, because what happens after a certain age is we feel like people stop seeing us. And there's nothing stronger than that.
Feeling invisible.
Right. And feeling visible is a way of feeling relevant.
Yeah.
But if you feel relevant because you're, you know, you're doing relevant work, or, I mean, you're doing some kind of service, I think that's very helpful.
Val, you have a great new project, and I love the title more than anything. Share it with us.
I'm calling it How Not to Fuck Up Your Face. and it came to me because I have seen so many women who have done something, and I can't always tell what it is, that has basically fucked up their face. And it could be, you know, from too much filler in their lips or their cheeks or their chin, or...
And we're not just talking about older women. We're talking about every age.
From 20 to 120.
As soon as you have money, you have the power to fuck up your face.
Well, yes. And even if you don't have money, because I just learned recently that there's something called... Oh, I can't remember the name of it. It's called CARE or something or other, that plastic surgeon and dermatologist offices often offer, that allow you to take a loan out to do stuff to your face. Now, the reason that I think it's important for women to be thinking about how not to fuck up their face is that I've seen so many professionals, that is, plastic surgeons and dermatologists, who are basically very beautiful. And you know, I'm not talking about all of them, because many of them are my friends, but they've done too much of something. And I am extremely interested in what happens.
Because they
to
have
our,
all the tools at their disposal all the
but
time.
But they also don't go into it wanting to look bad, right?
So absolutely
you
not.
You can't like grab the hand of your dermatologist and say,
what's
that's
going
too
on?
Too much. Yeah. Stop with the Sculptra,
right.
Whatever.
Right. Or, you know, when you, as I happened recently, I was in a restaurant and a couple of women got up to leave the restaurant. And as they were leaving, the restaurant went dead. You could hear the cutlery dropping on the plates. And they kind of like were swanning out of this restaurant thinking they looked fantastic. And people were staring at them because they looked weird.
Yeah.
So that distortion, whatever it is, that dysmorphia that we, that some of us are vulnerable to me is fascinating.
We do it with our bodies too now, not just our faces. Mm-hmm. Yes. The giant, like, Brazilian butt lifts, I guess, that are injectable.
Well, you know where
that
came from.
Yes. I think we all know.
And then the giant breasts and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. We're changing everything. Mm-hmm. So it's not just our faces anymore.
And have you found for this project that there's kind of a way to see more clearly and a way to control it, to change something that, as you said earlier, it's really, really bothering you,
so,
but not too much?
It's so complicated.
Okay. That's why it's a whole big multimedia project, right?
Yes, whatever that means.
Well, I can't wait. So let me ask you about compliment culture, because I feel like this is something that really pervades women's relationships. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think it's really useful, but, you know, I do feel like we live in a culture where the first thing women say to one another is, oh my God, you look great. And there's a... And maybe it's just the bubbles, the fizz that we need in our conversation. Maybe it's a way to show compassion for others or encourage self-compassion. Maybe it runs deeper. But sometimes I also feel like, do we need to do this? Do we need to do this Japanese bowing contest of you look great, no, you look great, you look great, before we get started on the stuff we're really there for?
So what I always say to people when I see them, and I hope I said it to you when I saw you this morning, is I'm so happy to see you.
Mm.
Because that's what I want to communicate. I mean, if I don't feel that way, I won't say it.
Yes.
But I'm not going to say, oh my God, you look great, as the first thing I say to someone.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, I want to tell them that.
Well, it kind of goes back to what you're saying. We all just want to be seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally does.
The most important thing. And I think Oprah is the person who said that, you know, first maybe publicly or in the biggest way. She said something like, all anyone really wants is to have someone actually see them. Again, you know, that goes back to Tara Wells' mirror meditation or, you know, my experience of looking at myself in the mirror. If you can allow yourself to actually see yourself rather than to only objectify yourself in the mirror, it's going to feel very different when you look in the mirror.
How often do you recommend doing that mirror meditation?
Every day.
Is that a daily thing?
Every day. I mean, you know, when you start doing it, it's going to feel really uncomfortable and you're not going to want to sit with it. I don't call mirror meditation. Mm. I just look at myself until someone appears there, you know, till I can actually see myself. But I think it's a very healthy thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Mirror meditation for all. That's what I say. Our listeners, if you want to follow and connect with Val Monroe, follow her Instagram. It's fantastic. This is Val Monroe. And I want to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And if you want to follow us, go to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at U-Turns Podcast, and let us know your stories. Do the mirror meditation and let us know how it works for you.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.